Hello and welcome to episode 31 of our podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name's David Grigg and I'm here today, as always, with Perry Middlemiss. How's things, Perry? You still got a house full of people working from home?
Three out of the four. Well, I'm not really working, but being retired gentlemen. No, I've got the other three in the house are all working, and two are here today and one is actually at work today. So it's a little bit quieter around the house with only three of us here. But
because we just heard today that the state of Victoria is a bit of a pariah at the moment in Australia, and the New South Wales government has locked its borders. People from Victoria can't visit New South Wales at the moment, and I don't think anybody else is letting us in, are they? South Australia has kept the borders locked to us, and Queensland has, and Tasmania doesn't want to know about us. So until we get the virus under control in Victoria, there's been a bit of an outbreak here. But once that's under control, things should hopefully go back to normal.
Well, you and I are not in lockdown areas, but we know a few people who are. And while they're working from home, it's more of a big nuisance than anything else. That we hoped that it wasn't going to happen and come back to this, but unfortunately
it has. It shows you the nature of this virus. Yeah, it's
so, sure
so
does.
So infectious. Yeah. Anyway, let's be a bit more cheerful. Let's talk about I think you wanted to talk about the Locus Awards.
Yes, the Locus Awards, number three in the major genre awards for science fiction and fantasy after the Hugo and Nebulas, although I'm just putting those in chronological order more than anything else. So Hugo started first back in the 50s, Nebulas in the 60s, and Locus, not sure exactly when, maybe in the 70s, but they're number three anyway. And they were announced over the weekend of June the 27th this year in a virtual event. Interesting to note that the Locus Awards trophy this year was designed by local artist Sean Tan, which is good. Good to see that he's getting a bit of extra exposure, which is good stuff. Now, as I think I mentioned at least once before, the Locus Awards don't do things exactly the same way as the Hugos and Nebulas. Those two awards basically have one award for novel, one for novella, one for novelette, and one for short story. But the Locus Award splits their novel awards into science fiction, fantasy, horror, young adult, and first novel. And then it goes into the shorter stuff as well. But I think we'll probably only get down to novella. I just want to get through these quickly to have a bit of a chat about them. The first one, the science fiction novel, was won by Charlie Jane Anders for The City in the Middle of the Night. I didn't give this a great rap when I was rounding up the Hugo novel nominees. But of the ones that are there, it's really the only... that one and The Light Brigade are the only two of the ones that are on the science fiction novel list that I've actually read. And it probably... it's a decent novel without it being super spectacular. How about that? Then we move to the fantasy novel, and we have Middle Game by Sinan Maguire, another one that's pretty reasonable, but again, I didn't think was terribly strong. I think the science fiction and fantasy novels this year, the best were in the debut or first novel category in this instance for the Locus Awards, and we'll see how that works in a minute. The horror novel went to Black Leopard, Red Wolf by Marlon James. I haven't read this, but it was pointed out to me that it was a bit weird to consider this a horror novel, but c'est la vie, that's what they did. Mm-hmm. The young adult novel, Dragon Pearl by Yoon Ha Lee. Haven't read that, although she's written a number of adult science fiction novels that I have read. Might be interesting to have a look at. The first novel, the one that, as I said, for me, most interest would be in, it does actually have Infinite Detail by Tim Maughan nominated for this award, which is good to hear. It also has A Song for a New Day by Sarah Pinsker, which won the Nebula Award. And the three that were big ones for the Hugo, A Memory Called Empire, my choice, Arcadie Martine, 10,000 Doors of January by Alex E. Harrow, and I wouldn't be Fastiff, that one won the Hugo. But the winner this year was Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. That was one that I had at about third of the novels for the Hugo. So it just goes to show you, David, I have absolutely no idea what the hell's going on most of the time.
It just shows that tastes vary. That's all it comes down to, I think.
And while I won't go deeply into the short fiction, I will mention the novella, which is run by This Is How You Lose the Time War by M.L. Motar and Max Gladstone. That's the one that I chose for the Hugo and has also won the Nebula. So that looks like it might probably be going to sweep the field. So that gives you a bit of a rundown of the current awards. There's lots more of them to come during the year, and where possible we'll mention them when they turn up. But there's going to be so many of them that we could basically do whole programs, whole episodes of details about these particular awards, David.
Indeed, we could. Or we could go for 3 hours at a time, which I really don't think we want to do.
No, I think our listener might basically fall asleep about halfway
right.
through.
And hopefully, if not while they're driving a car, yes.
Oh, yes.
All right, so last episode we spent quite a bit of time talking about alternate history novels, and we focused in on the alternate timelines where the Nazis, the Germans, won the Second World War, or the Axis powers, I should say, won the Second World War. So one of the things I was hoping to talk about last time but didn't actually get into was another sort of major theme of alternate history novels, which is where the Confederate states won the Civil War, the American Civil War. And in order to prepare for that, I read a book which was kind of, I think, probably seen as one of the early titles following that theme in history. And that's Bring the Jubilee by Ward Moore. And that was written in 1952. So I read that as part of sort of following up this particular theme and say, in this one, it's not the Nazis, it's the Confederate States who win a major war. So I found this really quite an interesting book. It starts off and the scenario is that Robert E. Lee had a huge victory at the Battle of Gettysburg and from there swept on to north and captured Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, and forced the United States to recognize Confederate independence. Robert E. Lee eventually succeeds Jefferson Davis to become the second Confederate president in 1865. But so that all has left the northern states, were still called the United States, as an impoverished sort of country. They've lost a lot of the prosperity that they had from the South. They've had to pay reparations for the war, and they're in pretty poor state. So Bring the Jubilee follows a character called Hodgkins, or Hodge, Backmaker. And he's a young man who lives on a farm in the northern part of America. And he doesn't have very many prospects there, so he heads off to New York, walking there on foot. And when he's there, he's such a hick from the country that he easily gets mugged and all his possessions stolen, all his money stolen. But he gets picked up by an old guy who sort of sets him straight and eventually introduces him to the owner of a bookstore, and he gets a job there. And there's sort of also a bit of a subplot of an urban terrorist group called the Grand Army, which is trying to cause trouble for the prosperous Confederate states, but that particular theme doesn't go very far. So that's the setting of a background of the novel, but it's really, more than anything, it's not so much a work of science fiction or alternate history as a novel of character. It's really about the characters involved. So really we sort of follow the development of this young man, Hodge, as he's growing up and as he's making his way through life. And his experiences in this bookstore that he works for, which apparently is quite autobiographical. Ward Moore had a similar sort of upbringing and worked for a long while in a bookstore. But there's a lot of coverage of Hodge's involvement with women. And I think for the times, they're all very well depicted and they're believably strong characters, female characters. Starts off with one young woman who's an indentured servant. Because they have this, although they've kind of abolished slavery in the northern part of America, they have people who are indentured, who have to sort of sign contracts for the rest of their lives to work for a particular organization, or, you know, unless they can buy their way out. And so anyway, he takes up with this particular young woman, but she eventually throws him off when he makes a friendship with the consul of the Republic of Haiti, who's Monsieur René Enfandin. And of course, he's black, and her racism comes to the front, and she gives Hodge the door because he's made friends with this black guy. Anyway, Hodge he's educated himself by obsessive reading at the bookstore, and he becomes fascinated by history, and particularly the history of the Civil War. And he's actually even written a few papers about the Battle of Gettysburg. And on the basis of those, he's recruited by this strange academic community called Haggershaven. At this community, he gets involved with a character called Barbara Haggerwells, who's the daughter of the guy who set up this community. And she's a very strange, very interesting character. She's intellectually brilliant. She's a top mathematician, very clever physicist, but she's got strange personality problems. She's sexually demanding, but she's emotionally cold at the same time. And she's toggles between having affairs with other men and being incredibly jealous about any of her men having sex with anyone else. So she's really quite an interesting character. And Hodge then also later picks up with a young woman who's been traumatized by seeing a violent incident, and she's lost her voice. She can't speak at all. She's actually from Spain and probably didn't speak English in the first place, but she's been struck dumb, and even if people talk to her in Spanish, she won't respond. And eventually she manages to conquer her trauma, and then Hodge strikes up this relationship with her. So they're all very interesting characters, and this sort of really interesting story. And it's really only at the very end of the book that there's a time travel component. This very clever woman, Barbara Haggerwells, invents a time machine. And Hodge uses this to go back to investigate his obsessive interest in the Battle of Gettysburg. And, of course, you can sort of see where this is going. By being there, he makes a mess of it, and history changes to the one that we know. So I like the book a lot, but more as a piece of literature and as character studies than as a piece of SF. So yeah, I thought it was very good. It was surprising to me how good it was, particularly for the time in which it was written.
I probably read it 30, 40 years ago. Remember practically nothing about it other than the fact that it's always been cited as one of the major alternate history novels in the field. And I think, did you say that Phil Dick had used it, given him the idea for Man in the High Castle?
Yes, that's right. It's what spurred him to the idea of writing an alternate history like The Man in the High Castle. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to read it. I should have mentioned that. Yeah,
it's probably one of those books that it didn't get as much recognition in the field. Well, it hasn't had as much recognition in the field now because it was published before the Hugos came out and before they started, so it didn't win any... Well, there weren't any major awards in the field at the time, but a lot of people still cite it as being one of those major works, early works of science fiction. So,
Have the retro Hugos visited 1952 as yet?
Good question, to which I do not have a good answer. Maybe we can have a look at the retro Hugos overall at some point do a bit of a run through about where things are. But no, I couldn't tell you whether they've got there or not.
Because I would have thought this ought to have been a candidate for that. I mean, so in terms of the quality of the writing, it holds up very well against some of the other books we've been discussing that got the Hugos in later years, in the later years of the 1950s or even the 1960s. So that's interesting. Yeah, so I thought it was a very interesting book.
Well, that leads very well into the first book I want to discuss today, David. The book is called Astounding. Well, that's the big part of the title. And the extra part of the title is John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. In essence, it's a biography of Astounding magazine and the major four writers that were associated with it. Well, writers including Campbell, who was the editor. So it follows the story of how Campbell, well, the early days of Campbell, how he became a writer, how he was writing under the name Donald A. Stewart. His major work was Who Goes There, which was made into the film The Thing.
The Thing.
At least a couple of times, if not three times. And that was his major work, but there was a whole lot of others that he wrote, and he was quite a good writer. But he found his forte as an editor, building up new authors to be able to write in the style of science fiction that he liked. The problem with Campbell was that he had some very deep prejudices all the way right through. And somebody said to me the other day when I was talking about I'd read this particular book, somebody said, oh, this is the book where Alec Navala Lee, the author of the book, gets stuck into Campbell and really skewers him. And I said, well, no, he doesn't. He doesn't have to. He doesn't actually, there's no judgment of Campbell or Asimov or Heinlein or Hubbard in this particular book because he doesn't have to. All he does is quote them and tell their story, and you come out of it and you realise that all of these guys, none of these guys were very nice.
No.
They were terrible. Mm. They utilised their white male privilege to the nth degree. Asimov was well known in the science fiction field, but unfortunately never really called out as much as he should have, as being a groper. He used to basically snap women's bra straps and, you know, pinch them on the bottom and fill them up. And he utilised his standing in the field to be able to do this. And he got away with it for a long period of time. People used to point it out to him and say, you shouldn't be doing this. He said, oh, I can't stop. That's not an excuse. That's just crap. L. Ron Hubbard, I think we all know about, because he basically started off as being a science fiction writer, though he didn't want to be. He didn't really like science fiction at all. But it was just where he was able to sell continuously to Campbell whatever he wrote and was able to make enough money. And then he got into Dianetics, which then morphed later on into Scientology, and the Church of Scientology was built. Campbell backed that all the way right through as well. And Heinlein, who was probably the best writer of the lot of them, he starts out as being sort of okay, though he's very much a male chauvinist, and he just basically gets to the stage where he just uses people around him. And none of, you come out of this book and you think, if you've got a real feeling that the Astounding Era is the one for you, I wouldn't read this book if I was you, because you're going to be completely and utterly turned off. You're going to be disenchanted by the people that were associated with it, and you're not really going to enjoy it terribly much at all. Now, this particular book was nominated for the 2019 Hugo Best Related Work. It didn't win, unfortunately, but it really is a very good book, although it does have a problem with being a biography in it. A lot of... And this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. You know, you're getting a series of events that people have undertaken, and it's told in a sort of a linear fashion. It follows one person through for a bit, and how they're associated with Campbell, and then it'll follow another person and how they're associated with Campbell, and so on. So it can be a bit on the dry side. You know, I think it's mainly for students of the field that want to know actually what happened at that time. You then now understand why it is there's been such a backlash against Campbell over the last 12 months, and why the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer has now been changed to the Astounding Award for Best New Writer, which makes a lot more sense. An interesting book, but really for students of the field, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I should read that book. I've got a book which is a biography of L. Ron Hubbard, which is called Barefaced Messiah, which I think is a brilliant title. And that just exposes Hubbard to the world, really. It's quite a shocking book.
Well, this book really comes out, and Navala Lee points out that he was a barefaced liar all the way right through. He basically said he did all this stuff in the war. He didn't even get close to doing anything about what he said he was doing. And That's how he got by. He just basically lied his way all the way right through. Anyway.
Yeah, sure. Anyway.
So that's an interesting connection to the stuff we were talking about just a minute ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's sort of period of time. All right. So I've been reading a bit more science fiction than that. So the next book I want to talk about is called The Second Sleep by Robert Harris. And I actually saw this, I saw Stephen King raving about this on Twitter, which is interesting because I didn't quite accept his view of it, but never mind. It's an interesting book. Robert Harris is the guy who wrote Fatherland, which we talked about, which Perry talked about in the last episode. But this is not an alternate history book. So it's The Second Sleep. And it starts off with a kind of a trick, because the setting appears to him in the Middle Ages, in the year 1468. And we're introduced to Christopher Fairfax, who's a Catholic priest, and he's travelling through a rainstorm on his horse to get to this little village called Adicut St. George. And he's going there in order to carry out a burial service for the previous priest there who's died, Father Lacey. But so it starts with this little trick, because we eventually discover that this medieval feudal setting, complete with peasants and serfs and lords of the manor and a powerful Catholic church, is not in the past at all, but actually in the future. And the time is not the year of our Lord, 1468, but the year of our risen Lord, 1468. So we eventually discover through what Fairfax investigates and just the backstory we keep getting filled in on, we find out that somewhere in the 2020s there's been a major cataclysm, think a pandemic or something like that, and the civilization has really crumbled completely. And they restart the counting of the years from the year 666, the number of the beast. And so by this year, 1468 of our risen Lord is something like 800 years after the cataclysm. And anyway, Fairfax goes to do this burial service, and he stays in the house where Father Lacey used to live, just for the duration, and he discovers the various artifacts and things that this old man has been gathering, which are all bits of the old civilization. And this is actually expressly forbidden by the church, that people should investigate the past. And so the old priest has really been guilty of blasphemy in this sense. And these artifacts are little bits of plastic and toys and goodness knows what, including a defunct iPhone. And on its back, this symbol of original sin, an apple with a bite taken out of it. So anyway, Fairfax gets involved with the local people there, and eventually ends up in a love affair, even though he's a priest, with the local widow. And all the while, he's uncovering secrets of what Father Lacey was investigating, which leads on to something for us to expect, really quite a revelation at the end. And it's a bit of a letdown at the end, because it doesn't quite reach that revelation point, which I was actually hoping for. The other thing I think about it is that it's a bit of a stretch, I think, to think that after a major collapse of civilization, an almost exact replica of medieval feudal society would arise in Britain. It just seems pretty unlikely to me. So anyway, so it was interesting.
Is this a discussion with Kierkegaard von Leibowitz? Because a lot of what you were talking about actually sort of is reminiscent of that particular book. You know,
it definitely has harmonies with that, yeah.
Yeah, and so sometimes you wonder whether people, authors in the field, have read other books and are actually in conversation with those previous books. Maybe not necessarily consciously, but it might be just something that's ticking there, and it's sort of like their variation on the themes that were carried through from the other one.
Yeah, it's a good question, but when you think about Robert Harris, he's not what we would think of as a mainstream science fiction writer, so maybe he hasn't ever read Kierkegaard von Leibowitz.
I mean, if you're going to read anything in the field, I think you probably would have read that.
Interesting to know.
But it is interesting to know. But it just sounds like a lot of the themes and a lot of the bits that you're talking about, the plot devices and the things that are moving that are ahead, just as soon as you started talking about it, it just reminded me of the Miller novel. Yeah. And so that's just what I thought of. So,
sure. Yeah. Now, the other book I wanted to talk about, but probably briefly because it's a very difficult to talk about book, is The Thing Itself by Adam Roberts. And the reason I read this was that in your interview, Perry, with Chong some episodes ago, he mentioned it as a book he was particularly interested in, he thought was particularly good. How can we explain it? A good deal of it is about Immanuel Kant and Kant's critique of pure reason. philosophical work written towards the end of the 18th century, the 1700s. And this is the idea that we're not really in connection with the real world, the thing itself. All we can our brains can experience is our sensory sensations, our impressions, for our visual impressions, our audible impressions, things we touch and feel. These senses are interpreted by the brain to indicate the real world around us. But the real world around us is really a construct in our minds based on these sensory impressions. And none of it may have all that much to do with the thing itself, the underlying reality, which is beyond all these sense impressions. And so that's the philosophical core of this book, is the idea that someone might explore this concept by inventing artificial intelligence rather than a human intelligence, which is bound by these sensory impressions. If we could develop an artificial intelligence, a computer intelligence, it may be able to perceive the world in a different way and maybe get closer to the thing itself. And by getting closer to the thing itself, make changes to it and manipulate it in all sorts of ways, which could be incredibly powerful. That's the core idea. And it sort of comes out at the start of the book where you mentioned the Thing by John W. Campbell, in which there was a film made. And so it starts very similarly to that, in that they've got two people in an Antarctic center, an Antarctic hut, I suppose. One of these guys is really batshit crazy, who's a guy called Roy Curtius. And he's been trying to build this artificial intelligence that can experience the thing itself just using the computers of the time. But somehow he's managing to make progress with this. And eventually he actually tries to murder the main character is called Charles Gardner, by blocking him out of the Antarctic hut without any protective gear on. So Gardner manages to get back inside. But he manages to get back inside by means of some really bizarre occurrence that happens, where he perceives really, really weird things going on. And he finds himself back inside the hut. He doesn't know how he got there. And so that's the start of the book. And it goes on. And we have these intervening little... We follow the story of Charles Gardner's life and how he keeps getting involved with Roy Curtius and how this AI idea keeps developing. But interleaved between those are these little episodes which are really hard to understand as to what they're about. They're set in the past. And one of them set in Vienna or somewhere in the 1800s. And you're just having this story about these two blokes who are sort of visiting, doing the grand tour. And then suddenly there's an alien invasion happening. And then the alien invasion happens, and then everybody just ignores it and go on and does their own thing. And then there's another episode later on where there's this stream of consciousness stuff, which the author admits is literally based on Molly Bloom's monologue in Ulysses by James Joyce. This stream of consciousness thing where she's having sex with people, and as she does, as she reaches orgasm, the Rock of Gibraltar, which is where she's like living in Gibraltar, the Rock of Gibraltar keeps growing. It's a very strange book.
It's bizarre.
What did you make of it?
Oh, it's bizarre. I thought it was like a curate's egg. It was great in parts, but there were some bits of it that I just found completely incomprehensible. I didn't know what he was getting at. Yeah. I think it's got to be one of those ones where I'm going to have to go away and think about it. I read this a couple of years ago, and I'm going to have to think about it and then go back and reread it and try and make head or tail of it. But it's, I think it's one of those books that you absolutely love or you just go, what? and I'm a bit more on the what sort of side. I don't really...
Yeah, I don't think I'll try to reread it.
Chong really liked it, and I know there's other people around that really liked it. No, I don't know. I was left a bit cold by it, unfortunately.
Yeah, anyway. So those are the two science fiction books I've been reading recently. So,
yeah, well, I sort of got to the point where I decided I'd read enough science fiction over the last few months. And, you know, oh, yeah, I got to the... You have to... you have to move away from things a bit. And I thought, I'll read this biography of Astounding. Of course, it's all about science fiction as well, although it's not science fiction. It's about the science fiction field.
Sure.
And I thought, oh, no, we're still getting into this. So I went back to a favourite. I think we spoke last year about me reading Sands of Windy by Arthur Upfield.
Yep.
Well, that was number two of his series, so I decided just to carry on and read number three. This one's Wings Above the Diamantina, number three of the Boney series of detective novels, of which there are 29. David.
Gosh.
So I have a fair bit of work to do to get through all this, but just plot along, we'll get there. A couple of years and I think I might be able to make it by the time I cark it. You never know. So anyway, this is set in the Diamantina River, which flows from western Queensland into the northern parts of South Australia. Now, you remember that Inspector Napoleon Bonaparte, or Boney, as he likes to be called, is an inspector of the Queensland Police, but he occasionally works in Northern Territory, New South Wales, and I believe also that he appears in South Australia and Victoria as well. So he gets loaned out by the Queensland Police. In this instance, he's still in his home state. Now, the book is set, as I said, the southwestern part of Queensland. Now, it's set on a large cattle station, which is run by a man by the name of John Nettlefold. Now, the book starts where he and his daughter Elizabeth are taking a driving tour of part of their very, very large property, about 1,500 square miles, whatever that relates to in kilometres or hectares, I don't know. Now, on the drive around, they actually come across a plane, a small low-winged monoplane resting in the middle of a dry lake. And when they get a little bit closer, Nettlefold pulls out his binoculars and has a look and says, there's somebody sitting in the plane, just sitting there. This is out in the middle of absolute nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they go over to investigate, and he has a look first off to have a look at it because he thinks she's sitting in the passenger seat because there's one, the pilot seat's at the front and she's at the back, or other way around, I'm not sure which one, but she's in the passenger seat. And there's no pilot. And he looks around on the sand around where the plane is, and he can see the tracks of the plane coming in, but there are no tracks anywhere around this particular plane. And when they go to have a look at the girl, she's completely unresponsive and basically comatose. So they get her out, take her back to the homestead, call the police, call the doctor. The doctor comes out. He also flies. So
sure.
He's a flying doctor. He flies out for the nearest town. And he comes out, and the local police come out as well with him. They get there, they check her out. They decide that the woman is going to be trying to be nursed back to health there. They can't work out who she is. All they've got is some initials on her clothing, MM, and that's all. She's completely unresponsive to just about anything at all. So the police go back out to have a look at the plane, and when they get to the plane, they find out it's been completely burnt out. Again, there are absolutely no tracks around this other than the ones for Nettlefold and his daughter.
Mm.
Now, this is a 250-page book, 50 pages in, and Boney hasn't even arrived on the scene
okay,
yet. But he turns up, and then off he goes, and he starts basically trying to investigate it. Now, a number of the things that he does here reminded me of Sands of Windy. And I don't think it's quite as good a book as that one. The plot's not quite as good. But where this one sort of excels a lot is in Upfield's description of the countryside and the weather patterns. Because this is set at a time where it's the weather is changing from the dry season into the wet. And so the monsoon is coming down from northern Australia and basically starting to impact on this particular area. And he actually has somebody go up in a glider in one instance through this, having to fly around near this very large storm front that's coming through. And his descriptions are fantastically good. Absolutely stunning stuff. He was a good travel writer in terms of descriptions of the countryside and what was happening around the area. And it really comes to the fore in this particular book. As I said, the plot's not quite as good as Sands of Windy. It's not as intriguing as the first one, although it is still intriguing and how this particular plane was, how it got there, how it landed safely without a pilot, how it was burnt later on, where it doesn't look like anybody got near it. Worth reading. Absolutely continues the sequence along very nicely. I gave it a 3.5 out of 5, so that would round it up to a 4, but I would have said the Sands of Windy were up closer to a 4 mark, but still a good entry in the series, in my view.
Oh, very good. All right, well, like you, I was getting to the stage where I was craving for something other than science fiction, and so I thought I'd read a crime novel. And this is interesting because regular listeners will recall how I totally trashed a book called Scrublands by Chris Hammer last year. And I didn't trash it so much as to say that I was very disappointed with the fact that this book was lauded to the skies, you know, absolutely reviews saying a masterpiece, fantastic, you know, the best novel since, you know, and yet I didn't like it much at all. So that I was intrigued by that and I read it and didn't much like it. But I thought maybe I must be missing something. I've got to be missing something. There must be more to this writer and this than I think. And I'll try the sequel to Scrublands, which is called Silver. And so I actually paid money for this book. And I'm still very unimpressed and think I wasted my money. So a quick plot summary. Martin Scarsden, who was the protagonist of the previous book, Scrublands, who's an ex-journalist, or is a journalist. He was a journalist in the previous book, and he's sort of now kind of retired from journalism. So he travels up and he arrives in the northern New South Wales coastal town of Port Silver. And his partner, who's called Mandalay Blonde, still a very hard to credit name, but Mandalay Blonde is her name, and she has inherited a property there. And after a few months they've been apart while he's been off writing a book about what happened in the first novel, he's now coming to live with her. And she's staying in a townhouse in Port Silver. And Scarsden arrives and kind of opens the door to find someone dead or dying right in front of him, bleeding to death, or having had bled to death. Clearly he's only just been killed because he's still warm, the blood's still flowing. And Skarsen's partner is sitting on a couch, sort of staring at this in horror, with her hands covered in blood. Okay, so that's kind of how the book opens, almost how it opens. Obviously, she's immediately a suspect in this crime, and most of the action of the book is Skarsen trying to clear her from suspicion. Now, it turns out that Skarsen actually grew up in this town at Port Silver, apparently without telling his partner this, by the way, when she inherited this property, but he grew up here. And so there's quite a few separate threads about his growing up experiences and a bit of a mystery to do with that too, a tragedy in his past, which we only get fully explained right towards the end of the book. But, see, to me, there are a few basics of a good mystery novel, Perry, and I think you'd probably agree. A good mystery novel, you should care a bit about the victim of the crime, or at least have to have some feeling that they have an opportunity to see why their death was significant. The murderer, the person who actually carried out the crime, ought to be someone we have more than a passing glimpse of during the course of the novel. There should be at least a reasonably major character in the novel so that we can acquaint ourselves with them. The actual murder event itself ought to be credible and believable. And it had to have been done for what seems, once you've got all the explanation, an understandable reason, something that makes kind of sense of the whole story. None of these, alas, is true in Silver. The victim's already dead at the opening of the book, so we don't get a chance much to learn much about him, although it turns out that he was a friend of Martin Scarsden, and we get a little bit of backstory from their childhood, but not really enough to give you any feeling of why we should care about this particular character. The murderer, which I won't give a spoiler, but the murderer really is almost a minor character who we barely get the chance to know. the mechanics of the murder, the actual murder event, is very hard to credit in terms of the way this has happened. And the reason for the murder is so complex as to be completely Byzantine. It's all to do with property. You know, I won't say, I don't want to give spoilers, but anyway, and because of all this, the reveal at the end when you find out who done it, it really has as little impact on us, or as little emotional impact on us, as a game of Cluedo. It was Professor Plum in the dining room with a lead pipe. You know, that's about the level of impact it had on me anyway when I read it. Now, the other things which annoyed me about this book, I mean, there's a few things, but for example, these coincidences, like the fact that this guy's partner happens to inherit this property in the very town where he grew up, and he doesn't tell her about this. The fact that he arrives literally within minutes of this murder, you know, talk about coincidence. And then the other thing, which is really annoying, and I actually commented about this in the first book too, is how badly this guy Skarsden treats this young woman, Mandalay Blonde. Like, so she hasn't actually witnessed the murder, but she's come, she says anyways, that she's come across the body momentarily just after it's happened. And so she's hauled in by the police, kept there for hours and hours and hours. He actually gets treated as a suspect too, and he has to spend a night in jail. So the very next day, he moves Mandalay Blonde out of this townhouse, and they go to stay in a little cabin in a caravan park. But so this poor young woman is being traumatized. But what does he do? Does he stay and he comfort her? No. Off he does. He goes, meets up with his uncle, who he hasn't seen in years, goes off their place, leaves this young woman behind, gets drunk, gets stoned, gets delivered back to the cabin, sort of staggering. And so that happens. And the next thing which really bugged me was she's continually being interrogated by the police, and she's got a young child. This I think it's just a toddler, or yeah, just barely speaking toddler. And so he's sort of, Martin Skarsgård is delegated to look after this child for a while she's being interrogated. So here he is with this child, baby in arms, basically. And he's on the beach, just, you know, having a beer or something, waiting to pick up the lady. And he sees a fight happening between two blokes on the beach. What does he do? He hands the baby to this total stranger, goes off, intervenes in the fight, gets King hit, knocked unconscious. And so eventually he comes around. Thank goodness the young woman to whom he handed the baby still got the baby, hasn't absconded with it. The medics examine him, tell him his arm certainly got concussion. What does he do? Does he go to the hospital like he's told to? Does he seek someone else to look after the child while he does this? No. He gets in his car, puts the child in the car, but actually it's his partner's car because she's got the child seat, borrows his partner's car, puts the child in the seat, drives off at more than 100 kilometres an hour with the child in the car after being told he probably has concussion. It's the things like that. It's the point where you just want to throw the book across the room because the guy is such a bloody idiot. Anyway, so I won't go on any further. To me, I think I won't be trying to read any more of the books by this guy.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, David. So when number 3 comes out in the series, you're going to be down sorry, there first day to buy it? I don't think so. No. Doesn't sound like you're not really selling this terribly well to me, David.
Maybe I'm being totally unfair. Maybe there are people. There obviously are people who love his work because you look at the reviews and he's lauded to the skies.
There's obviously he's been nominated for prizes around the place everywhere. And
doesn't do it for me.
No, you've just obviously that's at least the one thing with the Bonaparte the Boney novels is that you can pretty much guarantee that there's a decent reason for why a crime has been committed, and it will take some ferreting out to be able to get there, but Boney does do it. And this being set in the these novels being set in the 1920s means that he's got to do it all by, you know, sort of brain power. Whereas a lot of the times when you look at these crime novels set in the 2000s or 2010s or 20s, that they seem to look it up on the internet. No, look, there's the answer.
Yeah, well, In point of fact, that may well be the way that people do investigation these days.
Possibly right, but even so, just it's not really satisfying, really, terribly much, is it?
No, to me, the reason for this, I say that there was just no impact as to finding out who done it. It was, that guy. Oh, who was that guy? I look back through the book. Him.
Oh, him. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't do it for me. I mean, there is another subplot which is more complex, but even that is kind of Byzantine. I won't give spoilers, but.
So you spent most of your time reading this book, shaking your head and wondering, why did I bother?
Yeah, that's right. But more than anything, I said this business about how he treats his partner gives me the irrits, because he treats her really badly. She's this drop dead gorgeous young woman. He's like 41. She's early 20s. 25 or something, and he treats her like shit. And you know, and there's at one point where she says, "Piss off! I'm, you know, you're totally unreliable. I don't want anything to do with you anymore." What happens at the end of the book? Oh, it's all back together again. Everyone's happy.
Isn't romance wonderful?
That irritates me as a model of the way that men treat women and how often women put up with such shit and still go back to the guy. And it's just. Makes me angry.
Yeah. Well, that harks back to the astounding book that I was reading about earlier, talking about earlier, when I was saying that all the blokes in there are shits. They really are. They treat the women around them appallingly, really, really badly. And they just seem to get away with it. I suppose that the problem was that 1940s, 30s, 40s and 50s, married women in the US and in the Western worlds were basically powerless. They couldn't do anything. Mm. You know, you would think that now... Hopefully, they have a bit more opportunity to be able to do things, but even so, there's still a lot of problem. And guys just, you know, exploit that, which is awful, which is really terrible.
Which is why I thought Bring the Jubilee was refreshing. Written in 1952, but, you know, the women there are not going to get pushed around by them, I tell you.
Well, Men of the High Castle's got a major female character in it who's very well-formed. Sure. And she basically is a very solid character who does some very interesting things that are pivotal to the way the book's run and how it finishes. So
absolutely.
It was possible for them to be able to do this, to write this sort of stuff, but not many did, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the trouble. They're certainly not in this genre, yeah.
Yeah, well, the last book that I wanted to talk about was one that I'd been looking forward to reading. It's Ghost Species by James Bradley. Now, I know that you've told me that you're not really across James Bradley at all, but I've read two or three others of his, and I was quite intrigued with this particular book, to the extent that, again, it was a bit, you know, every now and again you come across one of those books that you really have to talk to somebody else about.
Sure, who's also read it, yeah.
Who's also read it. And so I was talking to my friend Chong, who we've mentioned earlier in this particular episode, W.H. Chong, who's one of the cover artists for Text Publishing, a blogger and a writer and a fan of science fiction. And I was speaking to him about it. So I thought, well, best thing for me to do was go around and have a bit of a chat to him about it. So that's what I did. Went around to his place and, you know, we're out of that much part of the lockdown, David. I am actually allowed to go around to somebody's house. So I went around to his place to have a bit of a talk to him about it. And I started by asking him why he chose to read this particular book.
I want to read a little passage from Clay, his previous book, in response to that question.
Yeah.
So this is from page 57. They might look fine. They're talking, this man's talking about birds. They might look fine, but they've stopped breeding. Or if they're still breeding, their eggs aren't hatching. Or the heat is killing the chicks. The ones you can see here are adults, because they're all that's left. And when they're gone, that will be the end of them. They are ghost species.
Ooh, good pick.
How about that?
That's not bad. Yes, that's good. So that's how, that's the linkage from there into this particular book.
I think quite clearly, which James Bradley, the author himself, says, he has just been thinking about this stuff for ages and it just keeps going on. He made some remark What was the one before this? The Resurrectionist?
The Resurrectionist, yeah. The one before Clay.
Before
yeah.
Clay.
Yeah. That's putting aside, there's a couple of young adult books in there, but yeah, just going on this style, yeah, The Resurrectionist.
Because it took him like 9 years to get from The Resurrectionist to Clay, and then another 5 years from Clay to Ghost Species.
That sounds about right. 2006, 2015. So, yes, 9 years between those two.
So you can speak to what The Resurrectionist was about, because I didn't get very, very far off the book. But he said somewhere in some interview that after that book, he got a bit burnt out or something, and he just didn't feel like there was another book happening in him. And then he said he came to this thought that he would only write about something that really mattered to him, something that really mattered in itself. And clearly, currently and since then, has been climate change or something to do with the way this world is falling apart. And that's how we get these last two books of his.
Yes, I think they do actually run as a pair. I think that you have to think of these two as a thematic pair, and you can see the threads through them even more so after having you read that passage from the original book. But let's have a look at Ghost Species first and sort of have a talk about what happens in this. Just as a brief synopsis, and there may be some spoilers in this. I should warn people that that might be the case, but that's what happens.
Do you allow that?
Oh, I don't think that's a major problem. As long as you tell people up front, they can just basically decide whether they're going to carry on with it.
It's so much more fun to have spoilers.
Yeah, I think, well,
but very painful if you haven't read the book yet.
Well, yes. But there's nothing in Ghost Species which I think you would find to be terribly spoiler-filing.
Yes, it's not about the plot.
No, it's not about the plot at all. It's about the... Well, let's just talk about what actually happens as a brief synopsis. Okay, so basically it depicts a world sometime in the future. We don't know, 10, 20 years, don't know. Doesn't really matter. It's just that sometime, it's a bit further down the track than where we are at the moment. Bradley's...
Can I correct you just
there?
Oh,
do you think there is a particular...
Bradley more or less says that it's starting like now.
Okay, all right.
But, well, you know, in a fictional kind of...
A fictional space. Kind of way, all right. It's like 5 minutes in the future, yes. Shall we say. Right, okay. So he's got this main character that's in the background of this book by the name of Davis Hutken. Davis Hutken's a tech billionaire. He's basically an amalgam of Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and any of the others that you want to name, all rolled up into one. And he's created this social media site called Gather. Bradley doesn't go into any details about that, and I'm not really fussed about it. I don't really care. All you need to know is that this guy's made a mozzer of money out of the tech industry, and that's how he's got it. Now, he, being a bit like some of the other tech billionaires, has a view of what he wants to see the world being like. And one of them is that he wants to be able to resurrect a number of extinct species. So what he does is he contacts two geneticists who are a married couple, Kate Larkin and Jay Gunasekera, and he employs them and brings them into what he refers to as his foundation, which is based in southwestern Tasmania. It's basically up in the wilderness, and he is talking about the idea of resurrecting extinct species. You get a bit of a hint about what he's doing because Bradley hints at a certain animal floating around in the bush in southwestern Tasmania, which you get only told about much further down in the book, is a thylacine, so it's a Tasmanian tiger. But you know, if you're an Australian and you read the description of it, you know exactly what it is. So you get the hint very early about what it is that this guy Hucken is trying to do. And it slowly comes out that Hucken has come to the conclusion that Homo sapiens has basically decimated and basically ruined the planet. And for his own reasons, he believes that reintroducing Neanderthal into the world would be a means of being able to bring it back to more of a pristine state. I don't know how he thinks that was going to happen or what he thinks was going to happen in terms of that, but that's what he decides that he basically wants to bring back Neanderthal. So he's got these two, Kate and Jay, to run this foundation to basically create a Neanderthal.
I'm not sure that's what he is thinking.
Yes.
He puts in a point. I mean, it seems to me unclear that Davis is anything particular. He's just some sort of cipher, really.
Yeah.
He's a very unrounded character in Foster terms. And he says very explicitly, right up front, he thinks it would be good to have some other species looking back at us.
Another viewpoint, yeah. Another way of looking at the problems.
To have a conversation with... Okay. You know, another kind of us.
All right. Okay.
So I think that's stating some kind of thesis for the book, but it has really very little to do with the whole Davis thing.
No, the whole Davis thing is really just a setup at the beginning. Yep. As you say, it's a cipher.
He's very thin.
Yes. He's.
Did you see the film Ex Machina?
Yes.
So the whole style of this is just straight out of Ex Machina. The buildings,
reminded me of that completely. Yeah. As soon as I started reading it, and he was talking about the this sort of isolated set of buildings somewhere in the back blocks of southwestern Tasmania, that's the first thing that I thought of. And then when he started talking about resurrecting species, I started thinking about Jurassic Park. But where Jurassic Park is very much that commercial theme park arrangement, this is a lot more scientifically based and a lot more based on the idea of we're just going to do this and keep it completely secret, keep it away from everybody. And so basically the book Ghost Species follows the development of this young Neanderthal girl called Eve, of course.
There is an Adam and Clade.
Adam and Clade in here. Oh, okay. There's an Adam in Clade. Yes, okay. He's very good. He's the main character in The Resurrectionist is called Gabriel.
Oh, okay. So it's very biblical.
It's very biblical, but it's also, he's takes a lot of effort, I think, in choosing the words, the names that he wants to get. I mean, uh-huh. K and J, there's sort of almost echoes of uh-huh. Men in Black here. You know, basically single word, Agent K, okay. Agent J. That's, I'm also picking this thing up. He's probably not, hadn't thought about that at all, and I'm just bringing things in from my own background. But
I wouldn't have pictured as a Men in Black kind of guy, Perry.
It's a fun movie. It's a fun movie. Just look at it as a fun movie and that's it. But I don't know why that just popped up into my head when that was happening. But I think that Bradley here is trying to look at a Jurassic Park-style development of extinct species, but not for a major commercial basis, which that one was.
Well, in Jurassic Park, it's sort of like a capitalistic spectacle profit motive. Here is kind of, well, the setup is scientific, philosophical, but obviously it's a metaphorical theme for the book.
Yes. So the difference with this particular book is this has a solid philosophical background, as you say. His main aim here is to discuss the ethics and morals of producing a new species that hasn't been on the planet for 5,000-6,000 years, maybe longer. Is it ethical to be able to do this? I mean, it's an interesting scientific exercise, but what you're going to end up with here is an intelligent, sentient being. And they may be the only one of their species on the planet. In which case, where does that leave you? Playing God and being an idiot, or trying to do something that really you shouldn't be doing? Or,
well, we are talking about Zuckerberg, Musk, Bezos. I mean, of course they're playing God, and of course they don't care about the consequences. Of course.
Yes, well, this is the point. He doesn't really care terribly much about it.
You know, I don't think the book cares about the question of the ethical question about resurrecting Neanderthals. I don't think the book cares. I think it's a metaphor image, and it does something with the difference, having the othering effect of the Neanderthal character, because in the book, half of it seems to be from the mother's viewpoint or the foster mother's viewpoint, and the other half is from the Neanderthal girl's viewpoint. So there is that kind of, you know, seeing you, seeing me kind of thing.
Yes.
But I don't think he actually cares about it, because he's not taking it literally. Because I think he's already said, you know, it's very unlikely anyone can do this kind of thing because there isn't enough genomic information. So it's just a pig. I don't think it's a kind of a funny sci-fi sort of teasing puzzle question that you're supposed to think about very much.
I think you're probably right, but He does talk about the development of the child and how the child is impacted by the fact that she is different from everybody else around her, and the way that she gets bullied and treated, stared at by adults who don't want to say anything but are a bit shocked with what they see, because she's got a slightly different skeletal structure. She's slightly bigger than a normal human baby. The face is just slightly flatter. The eyes are slightly further apart. So she is different. But children notice it a lot more than the adults do.
I read in a very kind of obvious way. I just keep thinking, this is about people not like us, migrants.
Yep.
Migrants of a different kind of a genetic strain, you know. I didn't think it was... I just don't think it's about Neanderthal, really. It's about... I think the ghost species, you know, is not the girl coming back from a dead species. It's about us vanishing into a ghost species. Because I think clearly the book's about us.
Okay.
And the future is about now. You know, it's all about now, it's all about us, it's all about the ghost. Is we are the ghost in the machine, and we're about to ghost away.
Ghost away, okay. Well, that's interesting. Yes, I can see that. I can see that point of view. Though he's not trying to set up Eve as being the new master of the earth, if you like, not the first of a large race that they are developing. It's just a once-off. So you're thinking that it's a more of a metaphor arrangement in terms of how we see ourselves and how we see our relationships with the earth and what we're doing to it.
You would have to think that in this context, the Neanderthal girl, and we see her growing up because it takes the first couple of decades and a bit of her life in this book, that she is a human creature that's closer to nature, closer to capital N nature.
Yes, that's the impression that I got, that he was trying to get to the point. That's
the contrast.
Yeah, Huckham was trying to get that point, that he was thinking that he wanted somebody that was closer to the actual earth as opposed to the rampaging cannibalistic ones that we've become.
Yeah, and we're eating ourselves.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean, it's tricky because, you know, it's a sample of one and she's kind of like cast as this good innocent. But what if she had been, you know, more like a, we must talk about Kevin kind of girl.
Mm.
What if she was kind of a maniac?
Well,
that would give you a completely different cast of this thing. So her innocence is a requirement for this story. And you know, to contrast with everything else that we're doing to the world, she's just trying to live in it, close to it.
You get that from the hint from the name as well, even though Eve is the first woman, if you like.
Well,
and she's also the first innocent woman as well, so theoretically.
She's first again, isn't she, sort of?
All the way through. When I was reading this, I was thinking that, as I was going along, I was thinking, has he bitten off too much in this particular book? Is he trying to cover too much territory? Because as you said...
So what do you think he's bitten off?
Well, the whole of the idea of the development of this woman from basically prior to her birth right through until she's probably mid-20s, I think we're talking about.
Yeah.
I was thinking that maybe At first off, I thought that he'd probably bitten off too much, and it was he'd spread the book over too long a period of time. But
Clay, when it was 70 years.
Yeah, I know, but...
That's three times as long.
Yeah, true. But I think that the way that he handled Clay was that he broke it up into those sort of small stories of people that are all basically connected and came together. As I said, I was thinking about this, that I thought that he'd probably spread it out over too long when I first started reading it. But the further and further I got into it, I was thinking, no, this is all right. This is now coming together, and it was sort of holding together quite well. And I could see that he was looking at a full life. I don't know why I had this feeling that he'd bitten too much often and the time period was too long.
It's because of the preface.
Oh, okay.
So in the preface, which only goes for like 1, 2, just over 3 pages, Bradley actually sets up the scope of this kind of thing he's thinking about. And in the preface, you don't know who the characters are. There's a mother and a child. And in the preface, the mother is sort of telling the child something as the child falls asleep. So she's talking to herself. And she talks about how, so for instance, this is in the middle of it. Sometimes, though, when the child is on the edge of sleep, she tells her one particular story, a story unlike others, a story about people long ago, a people who were not quite us. For as long as they could remember, these people had lived on the plains in Africa, moving in bands through its vast spaces, hunting and singing. La 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 la. Millennia passed, and her people were happy until one day some of them grew restless and decided to head north through the mountains. There were new places peopled by new creatures. La 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 la. And then one day the snow began to creep south. So, you know, he sets this in right back to then. So he's talking about, you know, the deep past in the way, I guess, he's also projecting in Clay towards the deep future, because he talks about the stars in Clay towards the end. So, you know, he's reaching back to the past here, and in Clay he's reaching forwards.
He's giving us a bit of a mirror there the other way, where I took that as being the mother there was a Neanderthal talking to her child, and the people moving out of Africa were the Homo sapiens,
right, okay,
coming up, and that they were the ones that were connecting with it. So it was told from a very quick vignette of the Neanderthal coming across the new species, and this whole book is the Homo sapiens coming across the new species.
Fantastic reading.
Well, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I just thought, I think what it comes down to is I started to get the conclusion, especially when you talk to somebody else, it's always better to talk to somebody else about these books, is that if you come across a book that you get to the end of it and you think, yeah, he did well with this, he achieved what he wanted to do.
Quite good,
yes. You can always pick on me for saying quite good. Sorry, it's just an affectation of mine. But no, I think this is very good, this book. Rather, even better than quite good. But I think that when you get to that point and the author has put a preface on it, it's probably a good idea to go back and read the preface again just to see how it all sort of fits in together. And just you reading that particular section of it reminded me that that's what I had thought of that first off. Now, I knew that this particular book before I even started reading it. It's not a plot. I'm not giving away the plot in any way, shape or form to basically say that the whole story is about the development of a young Neanderthal girl. That's well known and it's out there. It may not be explicitly stated on the back of the book, but any reviews you read, you can't get away from that. So that's what's going to be there. So I knew that was going to be the case. And reading this and talking about that millennia ago they moved out of Africa, that sort of gave me the impression that, you know, the Neanderthals went out first and then the Homo sapiens came out afterwards and then moved up into southern parts of Europe and basically pushed the Neanderthal all the way right down through to the southern parts of the Iberian Peninsula. And he actually talks at one stage there about somebody finding an underwater cave at some point where they have found the last remnants of the Neanderthal in Europe. So your overall impressions, what did you think? Do you think that you set out to achieve something and got there?
Oh, yes, I'm sure he set out with something in mind. Though, you know, writers always say that they don't have a program. But also at the same time, he's obviously, because he writes quite a bit of journalism type stuff, very explicitly about the issues of climate change and the apocalypse we are facing, apocalypse being the Greek or Latin for revelation. So these are kind of apocalyptic sort of fictions in the sense of revelation. And he obviously finds it a very urgent topic for himself, as, you know, he's seems to be not thinking about very much else. And he's in this also his own personal situation is that he's got young kids. Both his parents have recently died. So I guess there's quite a lot in his mind about survival, you know. How do you survive something? How do you survive something in the sense of being what's left after something else has gone? I think it's, I mean, I don't know what this mission was, and I don't know whether he would be willing to put it into such blunt language. But if he's trying to make, so this is a rhetorical bit I'm about to put here. So if he's trying to make something that feels atmospherically bleak about our future on this planet, if he's trying to give a sense of how much the world is surely and not so slowly falling apart, if he's trying to provoke a sense of dread in the reader, he's certainly succeeded with me.
He does have, he tells the story against the background of environmental collapse. You get snippets of things that are happening in the background, of the collapse of a large ice shelf in Antarctica, the breakdown of governments, but he doesn't dwell on that because he's more interested in the personal story and the personal journey of Eve and Kay, for that matter.
But he puts in plenty in those small snippets.
Oh, he
so
does,
you
yeah.
get the the sense very clearly, you know. It's just like the world is no longer in any sense normal.
There's a certain point that he has reached the point where there's no question that this is going to happen. It's just a part of the background of the future timeline that he is outlining, and there's no debate about it. This is what's going to happen. But it's the ramifications of it and how it impacts the characters here that he's interested in, rather than the bigger picture.
Here are two bits unmarked, which speaks of that kind of thing. And they're two pages apart. So on page 166, one of the characters talks about the death of a parent. Vanessa nodded. You think because you know it's coming, it will be easier that you'll be prepared. But you're not. It's like one day you're somewhere you know, and the next day you're standing on another shore looking back at this world. Then two pages later, Kate, who's the foster mother, has this going through her head. There is something numbing about this process, a sense that with each new diminution, the world slips further out of alignment. Yet while Jay and Cassie and many of her colleagues feel the same, few of them talk about it, except in the most guarded terms. And out in the street or the supermarket, it is as if nothing has changed. Do people not feel it, the way death shadows them? This sense the world is coming apart, this sense that they're all a part of it. So these things just kind of run right through the whole book, you know, like walnuts in a brownie. And you just can't get away from them. Every time you turn the page, you crunch upon a walnut of grief or, you know, of incipient horror.
Yes, and he's aware of that, but he doesn't beat you over the head with it, but it is there the whole way. You can tell that it's there. And it's a very quietly written book, and it gradually builds the whole picture.
Did you find yourself moved, or did you feel emotional about any bits of the book?
Yes. Well, reading parts of this, as you put that part about losing a parent, after losing a parent about 2 weeks before I read it, yes, there are some parts that are emotional in it. And there weren't any that I felt, no, I can't read this, I have to put this down. Because sometimes I've read books where you get the point where, no, I just can't go on with this at the moment, I've got to put this aside and then come back to it when I'm in a better frame of mind. I didn't have that. But there's that, it's that whole thing that people have said to me, for example, about parents dying. Not my parent, my father recently, but my mother a long time ago. Somebody asked me once whether I was over my mother's death, and I just said, well, you never get over it, you just learn to live with it. Just becomes part of you. That is part of what you are, and it's part of this whole book as well. You can see it all flowing all the way right through, and I think that's what rounds this book out to make it quite a good science fiction novel and quite a good literary novel as well.
You're actually going to draw them into two separate baskets.
I'm putting them together. I don't think that although Bradley has said that he read a lot of science fiction back in his teens, as a lot of us did. Read a lot of comics at that stage. But when he started to write, he sort of wasn't writing in that particular way. I think he went through and did an English degree at the University of Adelaide. And he was there at the same time as Sean Williams, who's the South Australian science fiction writer. And so they only found out that they were writing in the same sort of genre later on when they met up again. But he is very definitely in the science fiction field.
Do you think so?
I think so, but he is writing.
I don't think so.
Well, I think he is, and I think he's very definitely in there, but he's writing in an area in that part of the field which, if you like, and I know this might sound terrible, is acceptable to the general reader. The general reader coming and picking up a James Bradley book is going to be able to read this and not read this as science fiction at all. But people that are in the science fiction field can read this and go, yep, I know exactly what he's going on about here.
I wonder. So I think nowadays, or maybe for the last 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, the young folk aren't drawing those categorical lines anymore. They just write stuff. So Scribe Publishing in Melbourne has recently published two books, which titles escape me, which are, one's kind of got a kind of a forest deforestation setting, and the other one's got to do with animals. And they just publish as literary fiction.
Mm.
There is no kind of frame around it. Robbie Arnott's new book from Text called The Rain Heron has a fable as its kind of central structure and is set in some kind of future not too far away from us in a place that's not named, but is not in any way set up as science fiction. The one that came out that made some waves some years back, quite a long time ago now, in Melbourne, which was called Things We Didn't See Coming, was like one of the early climate fiction books.
And
was entirely
loved it.
It's entirely sort of sold as literary fiction.
Clade reminded me very, very much of that book. And I really liked that Amsterdam book. I thought it was great.
So I think this stuff, and they are mostly set in some kind of very near future. I don't think that writers or publishers think about that division anymore.
They probably
unless they're writing about, you know, kind of space opera things, or obviously squids in space or whatever.
Talking squids.
When it's just this, like, even when people, I think nowadays, when they buy Margaret Atwood's speculative fiction, they're not thinking about it as sci-fi. They're thinking, this is a Margaret Atwood book, which is a parable about patriarchal control. Mm. The whole notion that there is now a science fiction and not, I think it's very old-fashioned.
It is.
All those literary authors who want to talk about it that way in a sniffy sort of, with the sniffy tone of voice, as it were, like Ian McEwan and so on, they're just wrong. They're way out of stream, really.
They are. I think that's right. I think, though, that there are a lot more of these style of books coming out, and I think that
which publishers are just putting in the mainstream. They're just sticking it right out there.
Yeah, well, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing on this book at all that you could even possibly construe as being a pointer to say this is a science fiction novel. Not a thing. There's nothing on Clade that would do that. There's nothing on The Resurrectionist, although The Resurrectionist is mainly more a horror, almost a horror novel.
Here's the first part. I mean, we were now, we're now talking about the framing of the book, okay?
Yeah.
Here's the first part of the blurb on the back of Ghost Species. When scientist Kate Larkin joins a secretive project to re-engineer the climate, I mean, how science fiction is that? By resurrecting extinct species, is that science fiction? Yeah. She becomes enmeshed in another, even more clandestine program to recreate our long-lost relatives, the Neanderthals. So, you know, they tell you straight out this stuff is what would have been in the old days science fiction, but it's just set out like, you know, here's a bit of fiction that involves this stuff because you know what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the climate. I just think it's... We are in a space now in every conceivable way that is no longer concerned with the idea of normal. No, there is no normal literature. There's no normal world left.
Especially when you get a year like 2020. Yeah. You get a year like this one and you sort of think, yeah, we didn't really see this one coming exactly as this one was going to happen. You know, we sort of had almost an inferno apocalypse across southeastern Australia in late last year, early this year, and then this virus pandemic hits. So there's a lot happening. There's a lot going on. And I think Brad Bradley's, especially in Australia, I think he's in the forefront of looking at this particular set of questions, and I think he's doing a very good job of it.
Mm.
And so I'd recommend this book.
Mm. Well, if apocalypse means revelation, then this book is a worthy champion of the theme.
I think we'll leave it there. That sounds like a good spot. Thanks, Chong.
Thank you, Perry.
So thanks very much to Chong for that particular discussion. I hope that it's come across and give people a bit of an idea about the book. I think it's a very interesting novel with science fiction themes, because we did have a bit of a discussion about whether it was literature or science fiction, and, you know, sort of, I hate that term, transcends the genre. I just hate it. Mm. So I'm just going to mention that I hate it, and then I'm not going to use it again. But it fits both sides. You can look at it from both angles. It's got some good reviews in Locus magazine, this particular book, and it's had some interesting, if strange, reviews in some of the Australian book review magazines. It seems as if the book has been given to a few people that really don't read much in the way of science fiction at all and have to try and explain to you what it is.
Mm.
Mm, don't get that. Anyway.
You make it sound very interesting, so I should look it up, and the other books you mentioned by him too.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Look, I think he's a major writer in the field and a major writer in the Australian literary field in general. And
I think. Yeah. I mean, there shouldn't be a distinction, should there?
No. Honestly. No, there's not.
There's no reason why a science fiction novel can't be great literature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what we do is we have a tendency to put labels onto things, whether we want to or not, and... I'm a bit too old to change, unfortunately. I'm trying to do the best I can, but I don't always get there.
Yeah. I mean, Ursula Le Guin was talking exactly about this in her Guest of Honor speech in 1975.
Exactly right.
You know.
But it's still there, still hanging around. And I'm not helping by bringing up the subject, so my apologies to James, to Chong, and to you, and our listener. So hopefully I haven't wrecked that part of it for you. But look, it was a good discussion. It's an excellent book. It hopefully will do well.
Yeah, good, good. All right, I think we've probably talked for long enough, Perry. What do you think?
I think so. I think we've covered enough books and talked for long enough. Next week, David, next episode, should say, we'll be having a look at what we've been watching lately, TV and film. Mm. Not sure if I'm going to be able to get to the cinema. Maybe they'll lock all those cinemas back down again, but there's one or two. So
there's lots of streaming happening there, so you can
there is.
Watch something on the streaming service.
Yeah, but I'd,
I'd actually like to go to the cinema and just sit on my own and watch a movie, David.
Yeah, I think, well, that's fine for you, but I'm afraid that it's a long while since I've been to a cinema because I'm a little bit deaf, and so is my partner. And unless there's captions that we can read, so, you know, closed captions, subtitles, then we struggle with most films. So we haven't been to the cinema in years.
It's a pity. Mm. But you could always go to those big Marvel Cinematic Universe ones where the noise is so loud that you wouldn't have a trouble if you were deaf, that you'd be able to hear every single bit of it.
If you weren't deaf when you went in, then you're deaf at the end. Yeah,
probably. Anyway, David.
Okay, no worries.
Good talking to you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. Catch you later.